considerations. Number one, the created order. The man or woman is attracted to someone who answers to them. That is, their Adam to their Eve. Doesn't this also include someone who answers to them in physical appearance? This seems to be different from the, quote, superstar, end quote, syndrome you discussed. The analogy of Scripture. It must be granted that beauty is vain, etc. But the Bible does mention that Sarah's wife was beautiful, that Isaac's servant found a beautiful woman, of Job, that his daughters were said to be beautiful. And let's see. I write this question in full realization that a woman who at first appears less beautiful than one would desire can be beautiful when she is known. I myself have experienced this more than once. Quite simply, my question is this. What part does physical attractiveness play in finding someone answering to you? Now, again, though, this shows great wisdom. You see what the brother has done here. He sees some biblical materials, and he's trying to reconcile them. And then he says, now, what is the one common denominator that I'm looking for? And then he states it. That's a very good example of problem solving. You take your biblical data, on the one hand this, on the other hand this. What is the real question? And then seek to resolve it. Well, I think the answer is quite clear. And let me just mix up the answer in terms of the order in which this is given. The scripture does mention that Abraham's wife, Sarah, was beautiful, that Isaac's wife was beautiful to look upon. Now, the very fact that it mentions these women as beautiful and hundreds of other women are not mentioned, it simply underscores what I've already stated. Unusual or striking beauty is just that. It is the exception, not the rule. If it were the rule, it wouldn't be mentioned. It doesn't say, and so-and-so took a woman who had two hands. That's the common denominator. But he took a wife who was beautiful to look upon. That set her apart from the average, you see? So that, again, the exception is not to be despised. If God gives to Abraham a beautiful woman named Sarah, he's to receive her as a gift from God. But he is not to assume, unless God gives me a beautiful woman, I will not look at her twice. So I think that's the proper assessment of those who are mentioned as beautiful. Esther was a beauty queen of Persia, she became. Exactly what she became. And it is like a Miss America contest, and they picked her above all of the others. Now, this moves us to this whole question, will God, and I touched on it earlier, will God direct me to someone who does not, for lack of a better term, turn me on physically? Well, of course not, in the sense that God is not going to lead me to marry someone whose physical bearing is repulsive to me. No. The point I was making, and I think needs to be reiterated, is how can I tell if there will be the kind of legitimate attraction unless I begin to know the whole person, you see? Because any man who can be in the presence of a beautiful woman, who's got the right amount of flesh in the right place and the right arrangement, and not be stirred, just lacks hormones. He lacks hormones. Of course he does. So you see, that initial stirring of physical attraction can be nothing but the stirring up of your hormones. And that's a pretty shallow basis upon which to begin or continue or try to build a relationship. Merely that your hormones still get upset. So that I think the proper perspective is to look for those virtues that are biblical, to pray more and more that God will give you eyes to behold what is true beauty. And then as you begin to develop a relationship, if it comes to the place where you begin to appreciate the true beauty of the person, the male or female, and yet there's just a sense of revulsion physically, then obviously God does not expect you to try to consummate a marriage in which you're totally turned off by a person. That would be a form of cruelty. So exactly what place then does physical attractiveness play in finding someone answering to you? Well, I think again I've in part answered that by saying we should make ourselves as attractive as we can be with what we've got. Now you can never turn Ford into a Cadillac. But you can sure put some nice hubcaps on it. You can polish it. You can change the oil. You can put some slip covers on it. It doesn't need to look like a heap just ready to go to the graveyard, you see? And it's amazing, again, now, someone would say, do you think it's wrong for a Christian girl to go to a few Christians and say, what's the best thing to be done with my hair in terms of my face? I don't think that's wrong at all. And I've seen some girls who've been literally changed from plain Jane to reasonably attractive girls simply by a change of hairstyle, a little judicious application of some rouge and lipstick, and a new wardrobe. And it's been amazing what it's done. Without in any way losing 1 ounce of true Christian reserve and that holy veil that a woman should have. Because, and this is where the other half of the apple book will be helpful to you, she deals very, very helpfully here. Wanting to be attractive and trying to appear sexy are two different things. You don't need to prove to fellas that you're a woman and that a woman's anatomy is different from a man. As I told a group of young people this summer, there were some of those girls going around trying to give me an anatomy lesson every time they walked. And I said, girls, I understand basic human anatomy. I don't need to have a lesson every time you walk by me. That's trying to be sexy. But a girl can be attractive and do the best with what she's got. And if she's got too much, she can do something to lose some of it, you see? And if she doesn't have enough, well, she can wear the kind of clothing. If she's one of my daughters is probably going to be unusually tall and angular. We call it spiders, our nickname. That's my Heidi, those of you who know her. And she's only 11, but she's already 5'1", close to 5'2". She's getting up close to her mummy. And, certain type clothes, if it were, takes the sharp edges off her bony elbows and her bony shoulders and her long, doe-like legs. And as she gets older, she'll begin to mature and fill out. Granted, but Beth is the opposite. Beth is going to be more squat, built more to the ground. And already, as father and mother, we're trying to make the girls conscious of this. So that when they dress, we're trying to cultivate in Beth the realization that she's going to have to dress in terms of the way God made her. And Heidi, the way God made her, trying to get them to see that they are to do the best with what God has given them. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's sinful not to do so. It's a poor testimony. And so there is this matter of making ourselves more attractive in the same way we do fellas. There's some of it you think you could do well to go to a hairstylist and ask him, you know, what's the best thing to do with this mop of stuff I've got here? And if you're too dumpy, start doing some exercise. Invest a few bucks in some barbells or a bulwark or something else and begin to try to put a little solid muscle where your flab is. Now, those are perfectly legitimate things. We have a stewardship of our physical frame. And we must continue to recognize that. All right? I think if the person who submitted this question doesn't feel it's answered satisfactorily, I'll be glad to meet with him or her afterwards. All right? Further questions? Certainly must have with all the material we've thrown at you yet.
I was told that if you want to know what a girl's like, and you are amazed by it.
All right, the question is, someone has been told, if you want to see what a girl is like, see what her mother is like. Well, there's an element of truth there in that, generally speaking, a girl will be strongly influenced by the maternal influence. But I would only say there's an element of truth in there because there are too many other factors that enter into the picture. The major one being the measure of grace that God has given. Suppose the mother's an unconverted woman, and in her unconverted state, she shows a rebellion to God by being utterly insubordinate to her husband. She's a veritable witch. She runs the show. She's domineering. She's bossy. Now, here, this girl you're beginning to be interested in, she's become a Christian. She's seen in the scripture that a woman's role is one of submissiveness to her husband. She's framing a totally different notion. She sees the things in her mother that sicken her as a Christian. It'd be totally unfair to judge that girl by her mother. Totally unfair. So that I think there's only an element of truth in that, but only. And I would never make that a rule of thumb. I'm not marrying her mother. I'm marrying her. I want to know what she's like, then I'll get to know her. Because a mother might have virtue, she doesn't. And they never have. Small comfort to give me, you know, if she's not capable. You know, the mother sure kept a nice house, but look at this one. All right? Good. Yes, sir.
How long do you think a Christian girl before he would depend on marriage?
I don't think you can legislate that. The length of time will be determined by many, many variable factors. Suppose the fellow and girl we're talking about, as in the case of what's happened in our own assembly, have attended the same church for years, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. They've sat under the same ministry. They've had much opportunity for casual contact. They've shared in weekends like this. They've shared together in prayer meeting. There have been many opportunities for general acquaintance, general knowledge. They know what their spiritual dimensions are, their spiritual perspectives, their theological concepts are. Well, it's obvious that a relationship like that could develop into serious courtship and commitment and engagement legitimately so much quicker than something, say, two of you may meet here this weekend and begin to correspond, and you live miles apart, and you begin to share letters, but letters are a very poor basis to really understand someone. Maybe someone has no gift of expression and only one-tenth of their virtues coming through the pen. Someone else, they've got 10 times more virtue in the pen than they do in themselves. In that case, the period of courtship would be much longer, and there's so many variables, too many variables to say you must court for at least 3 months or 6 months. I think it's safe to say, it's better to err by being a little cautious and waiting a little longer to commit yourself than to get burnt. But I think in every relationship, where it's developed to the place where there's really some measure of self-disclosure, then it's unfair for a fellow to keep their girl, if she's of marriageable age, just hanging there in a state of limbo betwixt and between. And I've had to talk to some of our fellows about that, and in one case I know it's prevailed, and the marriage has been resolved. I ain't looking at nobody. I can just feel the heat from his red face.
You're still not throwing up.
This is their first anniversary. 1 week, they were married last week. All right, further questions? Yes, Bob?
One of the things that kind of cropped up for me in school was the idea of sort of communal day where a bunch of guys kind of go over there, a bunch of girls, and especially prevalent in Christian circles, where there wasn't the idea of putting the ego on the line and saying, would you go out with me or would you like to spend the evening together? It was just sort of, you know, hey, we're doing pleasure stuff and why don't you like to come along? And that got to the point, like, towards the end of my senior year, it was always that way. And it was never any more of that personal contact and like I said, putting the male ego on the line to be turned down and things like that. And it felt really bad. I'm probably going to comment on that.
Yes. I think it's a very vital matter that Bob has brought up, that it is an ideal situation, if possible, to get eligible males and females together in a generally structured situation that is not one-on-one. You share a basic Christian perspective, much like the Friday night class that, you know, that the number of you go to back at Trinity. However, this situation can't remain static. One of two things happens. Either you begin to feel uncomfortable in that kind of mixed situation, or when you get negative polarity next to positive polarity, something's going to happen. So what happens is, and I think this is, we see it happening in our own situation,
You know, I mean, I've had a number of guys come to me in the past few weeks, all of them attend that Friday night class. I ain't squealing, but I've had them coming. Squealing. What do I do, Pastor? I can no longer just look at a dozen Christian girls, but I find my eyes going to one amongst those dozen. See? So that this then, and this is what's good with it, it gives you that non-structured situation to begin to see people in a general way, but then it will lead to the singling out of that one that you would like to strike a deeper acquaintance with. And that's perfectly normal and natural, and people should not feel, oh, our situation's getting spoiled, now some want to go one-on-one, see? No, no. It is abnormal for people of marriageable age to be content with mixed social groups. If you can be content with that, you probably have the gift of celibacy. I said to my wife time after time, I said, honey, am I some kind of a wicked old man? I said, man, if I was sitting here in Trinity Church, a single man, with the available girl, with the character traits that I've seen in many of them, I would at least have tried with about three or four of them. Whether I'd have gotten to first base, I don't know, but just to sit and not try. It's an anomaly to me, and it leads me to believe that there are these problems. Because the order of the day is disrupted domestic circumstances and sexual perversion and lack of identity of maleness and femaleness, there are these fears that are indisposing people, short-circuiting, I guess is the best way, short-circuiting their normal, God-given maturation in this whole area of desiring someone of the opposite sex, etc. And that's why I hope a weekend like this will help to mend some of those circuits, so that you begin to send out the right to measure signals. All right? Bob, is that... Yes, sir. Well, we'll try to move it if we can help.
A weekend like this is a refreshing to me, to some of us, because we have a situation where, you know, something like this is the only communication that performs an existence.
Yes, I know you are, brother. The laughter is really just... It's just the echo of others' convictions. I had my ego wounding before I came. Well, I think this is where proper pastoral counseling and proper pastoral perspective is so essential. I think it's high time in our evangelical churches and our Reformed churches as well that we come head-on with this matter of singleness. That's what I've tried to do in preparing these lectures, to come at the thing head-on. It's a problem, and it's a real problem, and it's really with us right now. And I think we need to get rid of some of our unbiblical concepts and hang-ups and some of our Victorian reservations in these things. And I don't have all the answers, but I think at least this is a start to get it flushed out where we're not embarrassed to talk about our singleness and the peculiar problems and burdens of our singleness and the peculiar things that you've mentioned. You know, you're saying, in essence, why, yes, I would like to put myself down where there were more eligible girls, but if I do, is it immediately, am I, immediately marked off as a woman hunter? You know, am I going to scatter the women like sheep before an angry bear, you see? And that's a real problem. But I think here again, if these perspectives are being dealt with properly at the eldership level and trying to give more directives such as we're giving here, then less and less, I should think this problem would exist. But that's a very, very profoundly disturbing question that I think we need to wrestle with. Now, I've come to the position where I no longer am at all embarrassed to do some cooperative matchmaking. In other words, I have never come up to any fellow in the church and said, now look, I think you ought to start taking a shine to her. I mean, that to me, that's none of my business. But these fellows come to me with this whole matter and say, boy, I just don't know, and I wonder this, I wonder that. And it's not beyond me to say, well, look, I've known this one and this one for X number of years. Here's the virtues, here's the vices, here are the things. Man, I'd give it a try with this one. And several of those have eventuated in marriage. Now, I'm not going to say I kidded you about this thing, but Roger's interest in Jane preceded my giving him a push in certain areas. I mean, he was in the way before I nudged him. I just helped nudge him a little bit. But there are one or two instances where, under God, I was able, actually, in a sense, to take the fellow's hand and the girl's hand and put together and say, now, walk a bit and begin to get to know each other, where I've seen those hands joined with a marriage offer. And I don't feel I was carnal in doing that any more than Abraham's servant was sent out of the Lord to get a wife for Isaac. I think there's a matter of God using the means. And I think we need, at this point, you see, if our pastors and elders will see this dimension and we'll feel that we can have them as a liaison, it will be helpful. Now, they can't choose a mate for it. Now, here again, some who are fearful of their ability to make a good decision. I've had some want me to choose a husband and wife. I say, wait a minute, man, I'm not taking that on me. Because if you end up with a mess, then you're going to blame me. And I, you know, I don't want that thing. I've got enough monkeys on my back without that. Does this help? I don't have all the answers, but at least I can...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty well understood. You girls would know better, you know, because you talk together and things that you wouldn't normally share with fellows or even with your elders. But I think it's pretty well known that when we have a single girl who moves from somewhere else and comes into Trinity, it's not just for the ministry of the word. I mean, isn't that pretty well understood by the girls? Or isn't it? No? Well, maybe you can see I'm reading into what I know. I mean, I've had people write me who shared this problem and said, at least there are more fellows up in your area than where we are. Would there be any objection to our coming? I said, no. Why should there be objection? And to try to give them counsel. So I think it's a legitimate area of pastoral concern. All right, further questions? Yes, Don? Yes, if we have scars from bad associations, then there are several things. Number one is simply to observe happy families. And that's been a joy. We've had two or three marriages in Trinity in the past two or three years that are the direct result of exposure to happy couples. People that I could parade here today who would say, well, I know he wouldn't mind me using him. I'll use Keith Gates as an example, you see, of someone who said he determined that he wouldn't be married probably ever if not for years. He got living in Geneva House, he saw John and Carla Spence, and he said, man, this is the greatest. And the Lord began to purge away those fears, and it wasn't long before the Lord brought him and Christy together, and they've been married now for a year. And I could say at least two or three others, I could name their names, as examples of that very thing. So the total exposure, here again is God's wisdom in putting us in the church. There's the healing power of the church. You see happily married couples. You know, you see old duffers like myself, married 18 years, and really, not just talking. You know, you could fool people in a retreat like this, but I'm talking to people who live there. You know, you see the interaction of the family. And that has a wonderful way of saying it doesn't need to be like that. This is what God's grace can make it. And then I think, secondly, you need to fill your mind with the biblical norms. Read Ephesians 5. Read 1 Peter 3. Read the story of the of that beautiful relationship with Isaac and Rebecca and how the Lord brought them together. Then read books like Design for Christian Marriage by Harvey Small, so that your mind is being renewed. It's that renewing of the mind that gradually then will rebuild those circuits that have been shorted because of these past distasteful experiences. Those, I think, John, are some of the tangible steps we can make. All right? Yes.
Another question on the basis of theology and criminals. You talk about God's redemption to make it happen to the church and to the poor people. The criminals are already not. In particular, you spoke about the gifts of sons of fear and the fact that you can be content. The God's intelligence or some of the criminals. My question is, how can an individual really know what criteria is involved? To know whether God has given you that gift. But if you don't see those things in your life, then can you assume that God is indeed your temple?
We can never assume anything with God, but I think we can say there is a presumption in favor of us. You see? Because again, his thoughts are not our thoughts, and we only see this little bracket. God sees the whole expanse of eternity and how we fit into that. But let me try to address myself to the question. Number one, how does a man know if God is giving him the gift of celibacy? Well, I think you need to ask a prior question. What reason do I have to believe that I need that gift? For instance, if God is laying upon a man's heart a certain form of ministry and he's already begun to show skills and aptitude for it, be it a pioneer missionary endeavor, be it some form of work that means he's constantly on the go, etc., and there seems to be clear indication that God is fashioning him for a certain career, and if on the surface it seems that marriage is incompatible with that career, all right, now he's got to wrestle this thing through. Either the career must change to fulfill the biblical norms, or God must give me the grace to pursue this career in his will, to his glory, while giving me the ability to remain single. And then if he prays, God will help him to be continent. That does not mean God will make a eunuch out of him and neuter his sexual desire. Paul said, I buffet my body and keep it under. And I believe he's referring there, among other things, of his own legitimate sexual desire. He says, he that hath not power over his own body, well, some do, but it's power over a body that still cries. You see, that's why the idea that marriage is a cure-all for all sexual problems, therefore, when I'm married, everything will be all right. No, if you can't control your sexual appetite now, marriage is not going to be a cure-all, because discipline needs to be exercised within marriage. Marriage doesn't make a physically attractive male non-attractive now to a woman, or a physically attractive woman non-attractive to a man. Your hormones can get stirred up inside or outside of marriage, you see? So that it's in the actual situation, as a person finds grace from God to remain continent, he is not committing fornication. He is not so distracted by his sexual drive. Some people are just come to the place where the distraction is overbearing. Just the sheer physical pressure. It's got that their sleep leaves them for nights on end, etc. Well, then it's obvious God is not giving them the gift of continence, and therefore they need actively to seek a wife, and if necessary, change the career to fit that marriage state. And then what was the other question? There was another part of it that in answering that. Yes. Yes, then I think there is a presumption in favor of the fact that you're going to need a wife, and therefore you need to make this a matter of prayer and ask God to prepare you to be a husband, because marriage, you see, 1 Corinthians 7 must never be wrenched loose from Ephesians 5, Genesis 1 and 2. And I've seen some guys that had the attitude, man, I got to get me a wife because I'm burning this passion as though the wife was nothing. But some kind of a passion reliever. I mean, that's all they looked upon. Well, that is a pagan notion. The same Paul who wrote 1 Corinthians 7 wrote Ephesians 5. And until a man is prepared to take on the responsibilities of selfless love in all of its dimensions, he's not in a position to take a wife. Here's the phrase I use with the fellows when I have premarital counseling. Don't plan a honeymoon so you're ready to live with the implications of the marriage state. And the implications are these.
The moment a relationship is consummated and the two become one flesh in the covenant of self-commission, the lad and to leave his father, mother, and leave his wife. Now what he's saying is, from here on in, you are an extension of me. I will be as solicitous for your well-being as I am for my own. That's Ephesians 5. So ought men to love their wives as constituted their own bodies. That's the proper understanding of the passage. Christ's body is his church. He nourishes and cherishes us because we're a part of him. Now he says, husband, you nourish and cherish that woman, the totality of her being, physically, spiritually, mentally, psychologically, emotionally. Every part of her is to be nourished as being a part of yourself. I say to the fellows, don't you dare go to a marriage bed to a woman delivered at 3%. For once there is the 2-1 flesh relationship, she is now an extension of me. And that's an awesome responsibility. And if the guy's problem is simply a case of jitters, and, you know, he just wants his wife to get his jitters, then I say, brother, you just better go out and start jogging 3 miles to get rid of your jitters until you're ready to take a wife. No, I mean that seriously, because it's wrong. And I've seen the 1 Corinthians 7 abused. Frightened. All right, further questions? Yes, sir. Interracial marriages? I see absolutely nothing in the Word of God that condemns an interracial marriage. I do see that the Word of God teaches and condemns a mixed marriage as far as a Christian and a non. I also see that the Word of God tells us we're not to tempt the Lord. And therefore, an interracial marriage would be non-desirable only to the extent that many marriages within the same race would be undesirable. There are certain things about it that would not be expedient. For instance, if there's such a diversity of culture, that would be true with two Caucasians. If there's such a diversity of cultural perspectives that people can't lock into each other's wavelength, then they ought not to marry. But to me, the racial issue is no more vital than those principles. So whatever would make a good Christian marriage, in case of boy A and girl B, to me, their racial identity is inconsequential. Now, there is a second area that we must be concerned about, and that is the matter of our particular calling and station in life. For instance, if I were attempting, if God had called me to minister, say, in the deep south, it would be unlikely that God would have me minister there and take to myself a black woman as my wife. Conversely, there are situations where an interracial marriage is a tremendous impetus to the gospel. I know a situation where a missionary friend of mine was laboring in the Philippines. He took a Filipino wife, and he gave him great entree to the people. It was his way, in their eyes, of saying, you people are so precious in my sight that I'll take one of you to stand by my side for life. An interracial marriage there was a great advancer of the call to the gospel. But these are the things that must be wrestled with. As far as a sinful, as far as it being sinful for one person of one race to marry another, I don't think there's a shred of evidence in the world. And there's some good evidence that, that the whole problem of Moses and Miriam, Moses and Miriam and Aaron was in this whole area, and God vindicated Moses' choice of a woman that was probably a black woman. Of course, that goes down hard with some people. And on the other hand, you've got young people now where that's supposed to be the in thing. See, I prove I'm real avant-garde if I marry a black man or a black woman, whatever it is. Well, a Christian, you see, he's beyond that. He's not out to prove anything except the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Okay? All right, we're time for a few more questions. We'll leave the crowd alone.
Yes, John? Yes.
Well, again, John, it's not so much what the differences are as one's ability to cope with them. You see, sometimes the differences can be tremendously enriching.
tremendously enriching, if the person is flexible. But now, if their whole mentality and psychology and emotional life is so bound to a given way of doing things, and they are very provincial, this is our way, and our way is the right way. See, that's provincialism. To say, this is my way, and it's good, but it's simply our way, and there are a lot of other ways that are equally good, that's a broad circle. But I've met narrow people who identify their way with the best way. Well, if you get two people under the same roof with two sets of their way being the best way, you know? So that, again, it's not even so much whether there is a different cultural background, it's how one is adapting to that, how one views that. And those things come out very, very shortly, Don, in any kind of the development of a relationship. It becomes very, very evident. For instance, when I go to Scotland, when I go to England, when my British friends come over here, I'm sure this will be true when I go to Pakistan this spring, there are certain people who are what you would call the typecast individual of that culture. You know, we all conjure up the typical Scotsman, right? The shorter, stockier man, the thick hair and the real burr in his speech, you see. Well, now there's some who are like that, and their Scottish way of doing things, or their English way of doing things, South England, North England, but you have all kinds of stripes, even in England. You don't want to typecast the average Britisher. But what will happen is some of them, it's obvious, though they like that way and they enjoy being that way, they have no notion that that's the only way to do it, the only way to think. And there's a broadness, a breadth, and a catholicity of sympathy. However, there are other people, they are shocked in every expression of their Christian life and faith. Unless you do it their way, you aren't doing it the right way, the spiritual way. Well, that's the narrow kind of provincialism. And this, of course, is the image that the ugly American conveys. You see, when Americans go around, oh, you do what we do, you do it only. And so that's true in a human relationship between a man and a woman. And if there is that diversity with flexibility, then it's a wonderful thing. As I intimated, I came from a very stable Christian home. 10 children, second oldest, like a second father to my kids, my brother's a Christian. Married just upon the marriage ceremony to 5 of my own sisters. All kinds of security, you see. I never thought about am I loved. And it never entered my mind. I mean, I was loved, so what? What's the big deal? You know, I mean, there was lots of security. Well, my wife coming from a totally different background, this has greatly enriched our lives and my sympathy, because I have been able to read the world through her eyes, and in turn, she's been able to read through my eyes things that she never saw. So this diversity has been tremendously helpful to our youth. Okay? All right, any further questions? Yes. I think if I read rightly what you're saying, perhaps we could phrase the question this way. Should we, if we, you know, finished high school and spent a couple of years at home, should we begin to think in terms of weaning ourselves away from our parents' oversight and control, maybe by getting an apartment with another Christian gal and beginning to develop some independence? Well, I should say again, you can't generalize. Some are able to develop their independence while still living with their parents. The parents are mature enough to encourage the development. So they begin to back off in decision-making and the rest. And maybe this person will come, this girl or fellow, and say, Mom and Dad, what are you doing? They'll say, sir, what are you asking us for? You're 21 years old, that's your problem. And they'll bend the child's nose because they realize that child must begin to develop independence. And likewise, the person recognizes it. So they can make that transition from dependence to a much more mature independence very naturally within the home. But there are some situations where the parents can't make the adjustment. I mean, they just still look upon you as their little girl or as their little boy. And therefore, the only way they can make the adjustment so that you can have your good, not evil, spoken of. Otherwise, every time you're asserting a legitimate area of independence, they look upon it as indifference or rebellion. And your good is being evil spoken of. Well, the Bible says, let not your good be evil spoken of. The only alternative then is to move out. Explain the reasons why. And then continue to show love and concern with phone calls and visits, etc. Much the way couples have to do when they're married. When they leave father and mother in that final sense and cleave to husband and wife. And that adjustment, you see, is not only difficult at times for the child, for the young man or young woman, but it's difficult for the couple. I mean, they've invested a lot of years and a lot of time and a lot of tears if they're good parents. Now suddenly to start cutting those invisible umbilical cords. No, it's easy. A doctor to cut the one in the delivery room, but this one is not one. You know, there's hundreds of cords that have been established, and now to start snipping them is not easy. So I think you need to ask yourself, are my parents able to make the adjustment to my independence? Am I able to make it under their roof? If not, in this case, it might be wise for me to move out. Does that help you to get hold of some principles? Yes. In the back? Yes, Solomon. Well, this again is a problem, Solomon, that it comes under the area of preparation. And if I want to be a husband, then I must seek under God to find a situation where I can adequately provide for myself, for a wife, and for a child. And may I say at this point that I'm glad that there is a turn away from this obsession with college and white-collar work and beginning to be some appreciation of artisan labor. Now, the difficulty is that in some trades, there's such a disproportionate provision made. Carpenters getting, not in California, I think someone told me the last thing, it was up to $20 an hour. Unbelievable. I mean, it was just way out of sight. And of course, this makes it difficult because maybe the machinist trade, the top dollar for a man who's worked for 20 years is $5 an hour. And he has real skills far beyond maybe someone who's only been a carpenter for 3 years. But in spite of those particular problems, I think the old Jewish notion that a fellow, every young Jewish boy learned to trade, that's why Paul could make tents. So that he always had something to rely upon that would make him a desirable commodity in the labor market, or give him the ability to have something to put into the selling market that was a desirable commodity. But that's another whole area, this whole matter of occupation, and maybe you ought to have another retreat sometime, an occupational retreat, Pastor Barnhart, in which we wrestle through some of these things. What does the single gal do to... She's praying that God will bring her Adam to her, but in the meantime, there's no Adam on the horizon. She doesn't even know if there's one down underneath the horizon. What does she do? Well, this is another area, and it's another whole kettle of fish which needs to be faced. Well, it's about time for us to stop. Is there one last question? And deal with this. Yeah. Right. Now, see, there is another element here, and this is what you girls should understand. Though it would be foolish for you girls to say, I do, to a fellow that you'd have to end up fully supporting. I've seen fellows who never really settled down to serious application to their job until they had the incentive of knowing they had to provide for a wife and kids. In that sense, a woman and responsibility were a tremendous means of grace to make them really knuckle down. There's a sense in which they really had no reason to stick at anything before. Now they realize, I got a woman's mouth to feed, or she won't even let me get a ring on her finger until I prove myself. And some of you girls could be real help to some fellow who begins to soft talk you and show real interest. You say, look, Buster, I don't want to be out bringing the gravy home. You show yourself confident to stick at something, then I may let you slip a ring on my finger. But until then, you just keep your ring in your pocket. Now, you got to be sweeter than that. I'd say that. Yes, Pastor Barnhart. No. Yeah. Yes, so generally speaking, lengthy engagements are not wholesome. Because if you're normal and all your systems are tuned in, once you know that in principle you've already committed yourself to each other and you're developing a real wholeness of relationship, it's awfully hard to put the brakes on that relationship. Because God has made us, so everything in us is being violated when there's that commitment to sharing life. And there has been developed the grassroots affinity and perspective of life and the world and God and truth, and you're together. It takes unusual discipline, iron will, and some pretty down-to-earth practical guidelines to keep that relationship from degenerating into fornication. And it's not because you're wicked, it's simply because you're human. You're human. And so generally speaking, lengthy engagements are not wise. So I would say to fellows, don't slip a ring on a finger until you're prepared within a short time, unless there are unusually abnormal circumstances, to consummate that relationship. I mean, as far as the other is concerned, often my counsel to couples is this. If you face realistically your financial situation, and you're willing to live within your means and scrape together for the privilege of being able to begin to live together as husband and wife, then fine, go ahead. You don't need a bank account, just so long as you're not tempting God. There is a reasonable means of supply with your present circumstances, and you're going to be content maybe to, you know, have arms straight for dresser drawers for a while, and I know couples could have done that. When we first furnished our home after we were married, we were living on a shoestring, and we just went down to some old side street in Lancaster and found a new set of old, overstuffed, outdated furniture, $50 for a whole living room set, and we paid another $25 for some slip covers, and we furnished our living room for $75. And it worked fine until you were able then, one by one, to begin to replace things with more substantial. So if the fellow and girl share this dimension of perspective, then I think, again, because marriage is a means of grace, and the only way to learn to start living together is to start living together. It's hard work. And there is that delicate line. You see, generally speaking, the average fellow girl is not really prepared for the demands of marriage before at least getting close to the mid-20s, generally speaking. And a girl always wonders, well, boy, you know, should I have gotten that out of my system? Had a couple of years in the secretary in the hospital. And if she has, and she gets it out of her system, then it isn't so glamorous for her. Where she goes right from high school into marriage, there's always, when she starts facing the same dishes, same dirty underwear, same humdrum, many times there's a growing discontent, you know, it looks so glamorous out there. But if she's had a taste of that and said, look, that's nothing. I like the home with all of its humdrum as the place for which God has suited me. But now if she goes much beyond that, or if a fellow goes beyond that, then they begin both to get beset in their ways that learning to live together is much harder. Because there's a sort of an occupying of your emotional and psychological joints over the passing of the years. And some of the most difficult adjustments I've seen have been with those who've waited too long to be married. In the case where it would be true of both. If it's the case where one has already been married and then can bring into the relationship the perspective of a previous experience where many times this can help them getting over that. Well, it's 12:30. Let me say, we deeply appreciate the privilege of coming and ministering to you. And there's only one favor I ask in return. Because the demands and preparation for this cut into regular study time, and I just couldn't think of anything but this stuff, even as I tried, I still had a lot of homework to do before feeling ready to preach tomorrow morning, and I would appreciate your prayers if the Lord will undertake, and I'm sure Pastor Barnhart would say the same. No, he doesn't have to preach tomorrow. He's sending down one of our other pastors to preach. So. He's got it easy, but I have to go back and take the adult class and preach, and then I have a full afternoon of counseling tomorrow, so I will publish it for the next time. Thank you so much.